I'm Theo Greenlee, a reporter with the Alaska Desk. That's a joint reporting effort from Alaska Public Media and KUCB, where I work in Unalaska, and other public radio stations in Anchorage, Fairbanks, Haines, and the Aleutians. It allows us to connect you with the issues happening in communities all across the state. You can hear our stories during the morning news, Alaska News Nightly, or online at alaskapublic.org. The Alaska Desk is only possible with the support of grants and listeners like you. Thank you.
The livelihoods of Southeast Alaska's salmon troll fleet are being threatened by a Washington state-based lawsuit that alleges the fleet is threatening endangered orcas by catching Chinook, the plaintiffs say the whales need. The suit seeks to shut down the fishery. The trollers and other industry supporters say the whales are being challenged by environmental toxins and habitat loss and other factors. We'll hear the arguments from both sides of this debate today on Talk of Alaska.
Talk of Alaska is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The Seward Peninsula Subsistence Regional Advisory Council will develop proposals to change federal subsistence hunting and trapping regulations and discuss other subsistence-related issues. The public is invited to participate in the meeting March 22nd and 23rd in Nome. More information at 800-478-1456 or doi.gov/subsistence/regions. This message sponsored by the Office of Subsistence Management.
The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters.
Hello, it's Talk of Alaska. I'm Lori Townsend. The lawsuit has been in the court system for about 3 years. The plaintiffs, the Wild Fish Conservancy, say in the suit that too many Chinook that the whales depend on migrate to Alaska waters and are being caught by the Southeast Troll Fleet in numbers that deplete the orca's food supply. There are only 73 of the southern resident killer whales left in Puget Sound. The suit is against the federal government and argues the government didn't follow environmental law and failed to protect the whales from the effects of the troll fishery. Supporters of the fleet say there are many other factors leading to southern resident killer whale decline. Here to discuss why they felt the lawsuit was necessary is Emma Halverson. Emma is the executive director of the Wild Fish Conservancy. Also on the line with us today is Max Graham. Max is a journalist who researched and wrote an article about the lawsuit in the Northern Journal, and Paul Olson is a board member of the Alaska Trollers Association. Welcome, all of you. You can also join our conversation, Alaskans. What do you think needs to be done to ensure there is enough salmon for whales, humans, and other species? What do you think is causing the decline in salmon populations, and do you think shutting down fisheries may need to happen for recovery? You can call us statewide at 1-800-478-8255. That's 1-800-478-8255. In Anchorage, the local number is 907-550-8422. 550-8422. You can also email us, talk@alaskapublic.org. There's a lot of interest in this case, of course. A resolution to protect the Southeast Alaska troll fishery passed in the state legislature yesterday on a unanimous vote. House Joint Resolution 5 calls on state and federal governments to defend Alaska fisheries from the lawsuit. So let's bring in Max Graham for reporter perspective on this case. Max lives in Haines and first wrote about the suit in the Chilkat Valley News, then for the Northern Journal. Max, talk about your research in writing this story and what happened when you took a deeper look at the lawsuit. You said this case is about a lot of things, but it's really about a technicality. Give us the overview and your thoughts.
Hi, Lori. Well, thank you so much for having me on. It's great to be here. So yeah, I originally wrote about the lawsuit for the Chilkat Valley News, just did a kind of short article for the paper in Haines about it. And then I just got really interested in some of the complexities that I sort of discovered doing that article. And it really is about a lot of things. It's about the troll fishery, obviously, and impacts on southern resident killer whales. It's also about hatcheries to some extent. And really, it comes down to, as I wrote in my article for the Northern Journal about, it comes down to a document that the National Marine Fisheries Service published in 2019 that reviewed the fishery, Southeast Alaska fisheries impacts or potential impacts on endangered species, including the southern resident killer whales. And we can hear a little bit more, I think, from Emma, sort of on what Wild Fish Conservancy's critique of that document is. But that's really what the sort of legal argument comes down to, is a focus on that document, which is over 400 pages. And as one troller told me, doesn't exactly read like a Tom Clancy novel.
Yes, I'm sure it does not. But important information nonetheless. So, incidental take, the biological opinion from the National Marine Fisheries Service. What is the tension with that opinion? Max?
Oh yeah, that's to
Yeah.
me. The National Marine Fisheries Service pretty much said in that opinion that Southeast Alaska fisheries, including the commercial troll fishery, which catches Chinook as well as coho and chum salmon, pretty much said that that fishery could operate without jeopardizing southern resident killer whales. But it was a little more complicated than that, and it pretty much the fishery service said, you know, this fishery would re could reduce prey numbers for southern resident killer whales, which eat Chinook, and as Wild Fish Conservancy has said, they eat a lot of Chinooks. Chinooks is staple food for them, and there's some concern that their decline is due to lack of Chinook. Although I know that you know, there's some pushback to that, and scientists will say it's a bit more complicated. But the fishery service said, you know, the troll fishery or the Southeast Alaska fisheries in all could reduce prey availability for the southern resident orcas. But to offset that impact, the fisheries service would secure funding for hatcheries and habitat restoration. And the hatcheries in particular would pump out salmon that would then feed the orcas. And so that was their way of sort of getting to that no jeopardy opinion, which they needed to authorize those to authorize the fishery pretty much. And so that's why, you know, when I said it boils down to a lot of things, including hatcheries, that question of you know, whether that hatchery program would really offset the impact that the fisheries service said might, you know, would be a potential is also what this kind of comes down to.
All right, well, let's get Emma Halverson in here now, the executive director of the Wild Fish Conservancy. Emma, I want you to sort of lay out why you felt that Wild Fish Conservancy had to take this step, and then talk a little bit about incidental take allowances and why the troll fishery has been singled out in that regard.
Sure. Thanks so much, Lori. And it's wonderful to be here and great to talk to you again, Max. I think to take it a step back, I know when we opened it, the kind of framing of this issue was, our lawsuit to shut down this fishery. And we really view this as a lawsuit to protect southern resident killer whales and to protect Chinook, not just in Puget Sound, but coastwide. And I think it's important to just take a moment to recognize, the southern resident killer whale population. This is just for listeners who aren't familiar with this whale population. These whales, their range is from Northern California to through BC. I know we said 72 earlier. There's, or I'm sorry, the I think in the opener they said 72, 73. There's actually 72 whales remaining in this population today. They've been listed since 2005 under the Endangered Species Act, and we've seen them precipitously decline since that time to the point where we're really not in a position of even being able to talk about recovery. We're just trying to talk about, how do we stop this decline toward extinction? I heard the kind of, Max, just respectfully, my understanding from talking to killer whale scientists is that availability of not just abundant Chinook, but large Chinook that the whales co-evolved with over millions of years. This is the primary cause of decline for these whales. There are other factors like prey, I'm sorry, vessel traffic noise and toxins that are being drawn out of, you know, their fat storage because of starvation, literal starvation from lack of available Chinook. But this lack of available Chinook, and at least in, you know, from the killer whales we've been talking to, consistently has been identified as the major cause of their decline. And so, you know, we are seeing few new births. We're seeing that the births that do occur are not surviving. And ultimately, scientists have predicted that, you know, we do not stop the rate of decline that is occurring today, within 20 years, this population may be past a point of return. And so I just bring that up to say this is not just a problem we're trying to solve. This is truly an emergency that many people in our region and throughout our coast are trying to solve. And when we turn to Chinook, we see that Chinook are facing a very similar crisis coastwide, from California really to Alaska. We are seeing in watersheds throughout the region that Chinook are on the verge of collapse as well. And when you have an apex predator that evolved over, you know, millions of years, that has 90% of its diet relying on Chinook salmon from rivers up and down the coast that is starving to death, we really see that as a canary in a coal mine, that we have a Chinook crisis as well. And so, you know, we've really brought this lawsuit to because we see this as an emergency. We didn't bring this lawsuit lightly, but we have been, you know, studying the underlying harvest data for this fishery over a good 20 years. And when we saw the document that Max referenced, the 2019 Endangered Species Act analysis, come out, and NOAA Fisheries, you know, our federal fisheries agency, which is responsible with protecting these species, admitting that, you know, the harvest that is being allocated through the Pacific Salmon Treaty, which is the overarching agreement between Canada and the United States, which manages and sets harvest allocation for fish that share waters in the U.S. and Canada, on the key pillars of sustainability, not over harvesting these stocks, and equity, sharing equal share of fish to countries of fish that originate from their waters. We really see the Pacific Salmon Treaty as failing to meet those objectives. And, you know, one thing I wanted to point out that, you know, Max talked about NOAA's acknowledgement that the harvest levels that have been set by the Pacific Salmon Treaty, unless there is some sort of mitigation, are jeopardizing the extinction of both four populations of Chinook in Washington and Oregon, and have been identified as not just a contributing factor, but a core cause of decline for the southern resident killer whales. Also acknowledge that the treaty negotiators were well aware of this farm, and they set the harvest at these rates anyway. So we really see, I can stop there, Lori, if we want to.
Yeah, I'd like to jump in here. And part of what the lawsuit references is problems with the mitigation plan. If the judge says, make sure the mitigation plan is legal, fully funded, and in place, and we'll see if it helps the whales in the next couple of years, and in the meantime, the fishery can continue, would you appeal that, or could you monitor and see if things improve for the orcas under those standards?
Yeah, it's an interesting question, Lori. I think at this point in the process, I'm just not having talked with my attorneys and staff about that question. I can't really say if we'd appeal. It's a little too early in the process for me to answer that question. But, you know, I guess I would just leave it there. Okay. Not to speak about how we're going to participate moving forward, but you know, we're certainly concerned about this issue. And at this point, what the court has put forward in their most recent report and recommendation, which was issued by a magistrate judge, and now is awaiting a final decision by the district judge, at least the existing finding at this point is, or the existing recommendation is, for NOAA to go back and correct the biop, because they have found that the mitigation, you know, the solution to the problem NOAA is admitting, is insufficient in the eyes of the court under the ESA. So it's technically, you know, the mitigation, even though the recommendation is that it moves forward at this time, has been found illegal by the court. And the recommendation is to halt this fishery to, well, NOAA is correcting its violations.
Okay, let's get Paul Olson, a board member of the Alaska Trawlers Association, in here now. Paul, you said if the fishery were shut down, it could mean 50 to 70% of the income for some commercial trawlers here, affecting thousands of Southeast residents. What are ATA members saying about this risk and whether they would be able to survive it for a season?
Barely. It affects all the communities. We're having people don't know whether to hire crew or not. Our processors are wondering how to prepare for the season. Chinook is 50 to 70% of our income, and we all operate boats, which means there's a lot of capital expenses. In other words, you can't simply get by on a fraction of your previous income. But look, I'd rather respond to some of the things that Emma had mentioned, because I think it's extremely inaccurate to say that scientists agree that orcas are starving for Chinook. It's quite the opposite. Most of the science specifies that it's habitat loss in terms of noise pollution, toxic contaminants. If you actually look at the data, which I don't think Emma has, even though she says she has, the coastal Chinook abundance is actually higher over the last 15 years than it was 25 years ago. And the orcas have declined anyway. It's important to note that there are three resident orca populations that eat salmon and other groundfish. Two of them, the northern residents and the Alaska residents, are growing at a rate of 3% per year. So, what's the difference between those populations and the southern resident orca populations? Well, the southern resident orca populations live in an area I grew up in known as Puget Sound, now known as the Salish Sea. I used to fish the salmon banks as a kid, where those orcas typically forage for Chinook salmon. And the salmon they're eating are toxic. It has also been a hundredfold, well, no, it's probably 46% increase in vessel traffic going through there. That's large container ships. And these orcas, they're our fellow fishermen. And the way they fish is they use echolocation. In other words, they broadcast a signal, it bounces off a fish, and they go catch the fish. It's the same technology that fishermen use. However, they can no longer hear because of this vessel traffic. And they are also the most contaminated marine mammal in the world. They eat polychlorinated biphenyls, polybrominated diphenyls, and a host of other contaminants of emerging concern. And what happens when the orca mothers become pregnant is they transfer their contaminant burden to the calves, so that both during lactation and gestation. So what happens is we have this young generation of calves that is really messed up. And if you actually look at what NOAA fishery scientists say, they're not starving. They actually try and feed them sometimes. They're sick. They're highly prone to disease. So, it's really important to clarify that what Emma just said is the Wild Fish Conservancy's opinion. It's an outdated theory. It's based on a correlation that occurred 25 years ago. And yes, in terms of the economic impacts to our communities, we have 72,000 people that live in 33 communities in Southeast Alaska that range from small fishing villages to traditional native villages to larger municipalities that depend on the troll fishery as the largest resident fishery. We support schools, hospitals, local businesses. There's 1,000 of us that fish every year, employ crew, processing workers. And yes, the loss of this fishery is devastating to Southeast Alaska communities. And that is why we have had so much support, which we really appreciate, from the legislature to our municipalities. We're thankful for it. We need it because we need to survive this.
So I want to remind our listeners, if you're just joining us, that this is Talk of Alaska. We're talking about the Southeast Troll Fishery lawsuit that's brought by the Wild Fish Conservancy. On the line with us today are Paul Olson, a board member of the Alaska Trollers Association, Emma Halverson, the executive director of the Wild Fish Conservancy that brought the suit, and Max Graham, a journalist based in Haines who has written about this. We've got some news related to this case that came in yesterday. Research published in the journal Nature, Ecology, and Evolution on Monday pointed to inbreeding as a key reason why the southern population is not recovering. The article says after removing dams, breaching dikes to create habitat, mandating that vessels slow down and stay farther away from the whales, and limiting commercial fishing, there has been little success, saying the numbers have grown by two since 1971. The research notes that conservation efforts have helped the North Pacific orcas thrive, more than doubling their population from 1984 to 2010. They also mainly eat salmon. The conclusion here is that inbreeding is a key reason for this problem. Emma, what's your reaction to this new study? Does this change priorities or direction for the Wild Fish Conservancy's efforts?
Lori, thanks for bringing that up. I've seen that study come out, I believe this week. I have not had a chance to review it yet, although I do know our staff are planning on talking about that with the killer whale scientists who advise us as a wild salmon fisheries group. We're experts on salmon ecology, but we really rely on our our colleagues in the scientific community who are experts on killer whale science to guide us on those issues. Again, I don't want to debate, you know, these underlying issues with Paul or on air, but I would just, you know, encourage listeners to go out and, you know, learn more about these issues. Because, you know, my understanding is lack of Chinook is a primary concern, but there are certainly other causes of concern as well. And we think that we need to be addressing all of the causes that are affecting killer whales at the same time. And we can't just ignore certain factors over others.
Earlier, you said that at this point, am I characterizing this correctly? You said that recovery might not even be possible, that you just want to hold this population steady. So are you accepting that they're marching toward extinction?
No, sorry, Lillian, I might have misstated. I'm saying at this point, we are the focus of efforts currently because the rate of decline is on a trajectory toward extinction. We are looking for actions that can halt the decline, and then we can focus on recovery. Not saying that this isn't possible, but just trying to emphasize the urgency of focusing on actions that can the most immediately be taken to halt the decline of these whales so that we can focus on recovery.
Paul, what are your thoughts about this new study that cites inbreeding as a main or key factor with the southern population? Do you think this could change things in court now?
I don't know how that bears on court, because the court's really about whether NOAA fisheries should produce specific hatchery fish that are eaten in the times and places where the orcas eat them historically. But it is an important point, and that's one thing that, you know, the biological opinion that we're talking about, NIMS appointed an expert panel to review all fisheries, and they concluded that it was highly unlikely that any one particular fishery would affect the orca. And part of the reason is, yes, it's because it's such a small population, it's really hard to assess. There may be just two males parenting most of the calves that are coming out now. So yes, it's the inbreeding. As you may know, these orcas, there are 10 different orca populations in the Northeastern Pacific, and none of them interbreed. But I'm not going to give up hope for these guys. They're changing their fishing strategy in recent years. They're moving out of Puget Sound, where they're eating most of the toxic fish. Puget Sound fish are mostly resident fish. They don't swim up to Southeast Alaska, and they stay in estuaries for about a year, which is really bad for them. And so, but they're starting to fish off the Swiftsure Bank in Vancouver Island. So, you know, if they can get a few calves, they're around more abundant fish right now, and they're getting away from the traffic. So,
right.
I think, and NIMS is going to address that in the biop. NIMS has already produced several analyses since the biop that was challenged in court by the Wild Fish Conservancy, and they are all coming around to the same thing. We have these other problems affecting the orcas, and, you know, just to clarify what the hatchery program is for all fisheries. There's 34 fisheries up and down the coast, Washington, British Columbia, Southeast Alaska, which is the very smallest of them, and the one that has the least impact of the stocks historically eaten by the orcas. And so NIMS's theory is that, well, we do have more fish, but if there's a low abundance year, we need to pump out a few more for the orcas. And that's what the Wild Fish Conservancy wants to stop. And if there is an extreme low abundance year, it actually would be very important for these orcas, in order to recover, to have access to some of these hatchery fish, because the Puget Sound wild stocks, as is made very clear in the State of Washington's report, it's made very clear in the biops, do not have the habitat to recover. And that's going to take years. So In order to help these orcas survive, we're going to need some of those hatchery fish.
All right, let's go to the phones for a moment. Eric is in Sitka. Hello.
Hi, my name's Eric Jordan, and I have a question for the Wild Fish Conservancy. Is that okay?
Yes.
Excuse me. Is the Wild Fish Conservancy aware of all the work Southeast Alaska trawlers have done over decades to conserve, enhance, and sustain king salmon stocks and habitat, including but not limited to outlawing fish traps, prohibiting ground fish trawling in Southeast Alaska, fighting the Southeast timber industry, banning high seas salmon gill netting, protecting herring stocks, founding the regional aquaculture associations like Northern Southeast Regional Aquaculture Association, whose mission is, in part, to assist in the restoration and rehabilitation of Alaska's salmon stock without adversely affecting wild salmon stocks. NCRI is committed to sustainable harvest management, high-quality fish habitat, and the highest scientific standards in carrying out its mission. Are you aware of all that work,
Emma?
And why aren't you aligning yourself with us to protect king salmon instead of attacking one of the most fervent protectors of king salmon on the whole coast?
Emma, your reaction to Eric's comments here about troll fishermen, he's sort of saying they're conservationists too, that they want to sustain the stocks.
Yeah, thanks for that. And thanks for your comment, Eric. I hear you. And I don't know if I'm aware of every single one of those actions, but I definitely, we have had an opportunity to talk with some representatives from representing the fishing industry who have shared that information. And, certainly want to applaud that work and thank you for that work. And to say that, we do not believe that fishers are to blame, even for the poor management of this fishery. Ultimately, as I said, we need to look, the Pacific Salmon Treaty, who has been allocating this harvest at levels that they knew were harming the underlying stocks that many communities depend on and the fishery depends on. We have NOAA, acknowledging this problem and working to mitigate the fishery. That was the core question in front of the court and the question we believe needed to be put in front of the court, which is to say, if you're admitting that these problems exist, we need a solution. I think that the science and the harvest data underlying this issue are pretty clear, and it's very obvious that harvesting in this place at these levels is causing harm. The social cultural solutions are much more complex. I don't think that's easy at all. And so, we believe that the court needed to hear or needed to consider whether this mitigation was in fact working. We believe, looking at the science and the underlying, the plan put forward, the lack of clarity, the lack of certainty of whether or not this mitigation could really work to offset this harm. We did not believe NOAA had met that standard, and that was the question in front of the court. And the court to this point has agreed that the mitigation was illegal, that it has not met the bare minimum requirements of the Endangered Species Act. I would say, we don't blame fishers who are following the rules, who I believe are good stewards of the environment. This is a management problem. And I think the Pacific Salmon Treaty negotiators put NOAA in a tough spot. And I think NOAA, in authorizing this fishery without having a mitigation plan that truly can work to protect these whales and protect these stocks, has now put these fishers in a really tough place. And I understand it's a tough conversation,
okay.
But we are, I would say, fishers are not to blame is ultimately kind of the underlying message I wanted to get across.
All right. Let's go back to the phones again. Matt is also in Sitka. Hello, Matt.
Hey, do you hear me? I'm just
yes.
parking in front of the dentist office. Thank you very much, Lori, for letting me on. I just wanted to make a couple of quick points. One, to the audience in northern and western Alaska, down here in southeast, we do not catch a Yukon River or Kenai River fish, king salmon, or any other kind. So just wanted to put that out. The other thing is that the Wild Fish Conservancy is saying that this is basically an emergency move, that it was the last dish attempt. One wonders why, if harvest is a problem, why they didn't move against the sport fishery in Puget Sound, which last year in the Straits of Juan de Fuca took 84,000 fish, king salmon, and which had a really decent return last year. And as the Columbia River did, which is the main source of most of the fish that trollers catch, trollers catch in southeast Alaska, they catch fall run Columbia River fish. That's the single largest component. And those fish in between 2010 and 2020 had the record returns of all time since they built dams in the 30s. So I don't understand why Wild Fish Conservancy went 1,000 miles away to attack a fishery here in Southeast Alaska that has the least impact on the fish that they claim to be concerned about.
All right. Well, Matt, thank you so much for the call. We are going to have to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll get reaction from Emma Halverson and Paul Olson, and we'll take your calls and questions as Talk of Alaska continues statewide.
Talk of Alaska is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Public media is designed for and made possible by the communities it serves. Monies generated through estate and deferred gifts enable public radio to provide our listeners, you, with the level of programming excellence you've come to expect. It may also reduce income and estate taxes. Consult your financial advisor or contact your public radio station to learn more. Not yet a member of this station? Well, today is a perfect day to become one. You simply make a donation. It's that simple.
Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. Today we're discussing the Southeast Troll lawsuit against the Southeast Troll fishery brought by the Wild Fish Conservancy in Washington State. On the line with us today are Paul Olson, a board member of the Alaska Trollers Association, Emma Halverson, the executive director of the Wild Fish Conservancy, and Max Graham is also on the line, a journalist based in Haines. I want to get some reaction to what Matt had to say, but before we do that, Max, you wrote about the effect this pending decision is already having on fishermen and processors. Talk about what's happening on this front.
Sure, yeah, Paul kind of alluded to this earlier on in the show, but I knew that this lawsuit would have a big effect, or a closure of the troll fishery in the future, if that happened, would have a big effect. But when I researched it and as I reported, I realized that it already is having an effect. And that's sort of what Paul was saying. You know, I went out with a troller in Sitka who didn't know if he should hire a deckhand this summer or not, because he doesn't know if he'll be fishing. I spoke with a president of a processor in Sitka who doesn't know how much crew for his plant to hire, because he doesn't know how much troll caught fish will be coming through the plant. He doesn't know, you know, how many tenders to contract, because he doesn't know how many, you know, whether the troll fleet will be out there. So this is, you know, as any business owner knows, it's really hard to sort of plan a business around such uncertainty. And trollers are business people, you know, as are seafood processors and so forth. So that was, you know, an interesting angle, I thought, just that the lawsuit is already having a bit of an effect on folks in Southeast.
Sort of a chilling effect. Paul, you said you didn't think this lawsuit, in an earlier interview, you said you didn't think this lawsuit would get this far. Why?
Because we don't interact with the stocks that Emma thinks that we do. So the orcas have a historical foraging strategy. As I previously mentioned, they spend the summer in the Salish Sea fishing on salmon banks off San Juan Island. In the winter, a lot of their diet's unknown, but they gather around March at the mouth of the Columbia and fish Columbia River Springs. Those fish, too, are not far north migrators. They don't go to Southeast Alaska. So of the, you know, there's roughly, if Chinook abundance fluctuates every year, there's roughly between 2 and 6 million in these orcas' particular habitat every year. Fisheries up and down the coast catch roughly 1 million of them. That includes the Columbia River fisheries. That includes Canadian fisheries. Washington and California typically catch about 400,000 apiece. Southeast Alaska, including sport fishing, which is another big beneficiary of this abundant resource, typically catches about 200,000, and orcas typically eat between 1.6 and 2 million. That's cited science. I don't know where Emma's getting her stock composition data from. We've asked for it and it hasn't been disclosed. But anyway, the underlying point being, we don't affect those stocks. And so what went south was the hatchery program. And what NIMS did, it's called mitigation. You typically, when you have something that may impact the environment, an agency has to develop a mitigation plan. Mm-hmm. And so in this case, the only thing that NIMS didn't do, they didn't really do that bad a job. They actually thought about what they were going to do, and that was to increase orca prey 4 to 5%, not for stocks that swim to Southeast Alaska, but for the Columbia River and Salish Sea stocks that they like to eat. So that we would cover them in the event of a low abundance year. Now, what they didn't do is specify how they would fund it,
right.
Because they rely, like a lot of federal agencies, they rely on annual appropriations, which they got. They released it. But at the time the Wild Fish Conservancy filed the lawsuit, that piece of detail was missing in the biop. And that's it. It's why, you know, Max said earlier, these guys are being pinched on a technicality. It's true. And moreover, that technicality wasn't even meant for us. It was meant to cover all fisheries, you know, tribal fisheries in Puget Sound, sport fisheries in Puget Sound. All of those fisheries are at jeopardy over this lawsuit because of the hatchery production that's going to be needed to protect these orcas or to give them an insurance policy, if you'll have it, against years of low abundance, while these long-term habitat recovery actions, which are serious, you know, more Chinook salmon can die in a single pre-spawning mortality event in the Nootskat River than will be caught in Southeast Alaska for years. It's been documented by the Northwest Indian Tribal Fisheries Commission, you know. Okay. So you've got these serious, serious habitat issues, and it's going to take millions of dollars to clean up. NIMS is working on it. But again, this hatchery program was designed to do it, and we got caught up in a technicality.
All right. And I want to give Emma a chance to respond. But before we get back to Emma, I want to return to the phones. Jackie is in Sitka. Hello, Jackie. Jackie is gone. All right. Let's continue on, and we'll try Jason in Copper Valley. Hi, Jason.
Thank you very much for hearing me. Habitat seems to be the biggest issue here, and I really want to bring up the toxicity of the environment. We've gotten lazy as a culture and casual about water runoff, about what goes into our toilets. The last couple of years, I saw more Clorox going off the shelves than I had in years past. And until we start taking responsibility for our impact, what's coming off of our roads, what's coming out of our toilets, what's coming out of our wastewater, it's not just salmon. We're seeing this impact in shellfish. We saw the impact in the acidification of the oceans with the crab fisheries. This is not the first fishery, and it's really easy to look at the fishermen because they're an object target, but it's really hard to look in the mirror. And when it comes to emergency actions, how about some emergency actions about shifting up the infrastructure for recognizing that we are impacting the environment? And until we start actively getting on top of the water flowing out of our drains, then we're going to continue seeing problems. Seattle, Puget Sound, Vancouver, that's a cesspool. That's the beauty and the reason why the Alaskan fishery is so strong and resilient, is our fish are returning to clean and less than polluted waters. Anchorage may be an exception. But until we start recognizing our impact on the toxicity environment, this is a continuing problem, and it's not just the fish. It's going to be shellfish next.
Yeah, thank you, Jason.
So, thank you.
Yeah, thanks for your comments. I want to get back to Emma here. Emma, Paul talked about the mitigation plan. One of the things that you said in an earlier interview is that Chinook are in trouble. The way you phrased it was they're on their knees in pretty much every watershed up and down the coast. So what else is happening with these salmon from your perspective, and what can be done to combat those challenges? The Southeast Troll Fleet isn't affecting all the West Coast stocks.
Yeah, I appreciate the opportunity to respond to that. One brief comment I wanted to make on the mitigation was to say that, you know, even at the point when the court ruled that the mitigation was illegal and therefore not working, that program was already being funded and was underway. So I just wanted to point out that there was other concerns other than the funding that was initially when we filed the lawsuit, one concern about the mitigation not being sufficient. But even at the time when the mitigation was funded and it was underway, the court still found that program was illegal. And that was both under the Endangered Species Act because they felt it was speculative and ultimately unlikely to occur. You can go back and look at the report and recommendation from the judge, and she really clearly explains why she found the mitigation was illegal. So I just wanted to make that point. And then I just wanted to comment to something Paul said. And again, I don't want to, you know, argue the science, but, you know, when we look, you know, he referenced this idea that this fishery in Alaska is not having an impact on other stocks up and down the coast. And that's just frankly not true. If you look at the Pacific Salmon Commission data, the past 30 years, the 20-year average, the most recent data that's collected through stock genetic ID shows that up to 97% of the fish that are harvested in this fishery are not from Alaska. They're from rivers in the west coast of the coast of Oregon and Washington. They're from the Columbia River. Nearly half of the fish harvested in this fishery would return to the Columbia River if unharvested. They're from rivers throughout British Columbia, and some are from Alaska as well. But majority of these fish are not from Alaska. And so this is a huge why this fishery has, you know, been concerning to us for quite some time, because this high proportion of non-Alaskan Chinook has trickle-down effects on communities up and down the coast. And also, if you look in some of the court filings, Alaska Fish and Game has also identified that 70% of the stocks that are harvested in this fishery are high priority prey for the southern resident population. And that's not our data, that's Alaska Fish and Game's own research. And so, you know, the concern when you are harvesting fish far from home, that's having trickle-down effects on other communities. And kind of when we were talking about, you know, other fisheries and how other communities are responding to these coast-wide poor Chinook returns, Oregon and Washington, or Oregon and California recently canceled their entire troll Chinook fishery for, you know, the entire season because of poor returns of those Chinook. On the Columbia River, we're having conversations in both the Oregon and Washington legislatures right now about whether or not the only commercial non-tribal fishery on the river should be phased out or banned, because we're just not seeing the returns that can support a fishery any longer. Even in places where, you know, I agree with the caller who said we do have problems with toxins, but we see in places like Clayquot Sound, UNESCO Biosphere, or the Skeena River, some of our most intact habitat on the entire coast, you know, where we are seeing fractions of Chinook returning, and where, you know, even for First Nations and tribal nations, in some cases, they haven't harvested Chinook in a decade, even for subsistence purposes because of low returns.
Okay,
so and just want to emphasize the coastwide impact of this harvest.
Do you think you'd said that if we want to save killer whales, we need to restore all of the stocks they depend on. Do you think all commercial fishing of these stocks should stop?
I think we do need to look at the impacts of commercial fishing, but ultimately one of the biggest concerns, and this is not just specific to the Southeast Alaska troll fishery, this is, you know, many of the fisheries managed under the Pacific Salmon Treaty. You know, we see one of the biggest problems being that by fishing in the ocean, in mixed stocked ocean fisheries, where you have stocks, as I described, from up and down the coast, you know, traveling as, you know, much like migratory birds travel to food rich sources and then travel back to their nesting sites. You know, our salmon are leaving our rivers, going into the ocean, commingling. And when you're fishing in mixed stocked ocean fisheries, it's impossible to protect your weak and your healthy stocks. And so we are indiscriminately harvesting ESA listed fish, which is, you know, why the ITS is needed in the first place, because we know there is indirect harvest of species that are threatened with extinction or endangered with extinction. We're fishing in the case of Southeast Alaska, but in the ocean, we're competing with whales for feed. And just to point out that in the grand scheme of how we have been harvesting salmon over time, harvesting in the ocean is actually pretty new in terms of the amount of time that people have been harvesting salmon. For thousands of years, indigenous communities were harvesting in or near rivers of origin on fully mature Chinook after they returned, or fully mature salmon. It's only been over the last 150 years that we've shifted harvest out of rivers of origin into the ocean. And so now we are fishing where salmon are rearing in their rearing habitat. And the Southeast Alaska fishery is unique in that that is, you know, a food rich nursery. Okay. Where these salmon are going to feed. And so when you're fishing in the ocean, we see impacts to the size of fish, we see impacts to the diversity of fish, the age structures, And so there is, you know, scientific evidence to suggest that we need moving back towards the ways that we fish sustainably for thousands of years.
Okay, thanks. We're going to have to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll continue this discussion about the Wild Fish Conservancy's lawsuit against the Alaska trawlers, Southeast Alaska salmon Chinook trawlers, as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Ensure the vitality of public radio by including it in your estate planning. Together, we build a sustainable future for quality media. Thank you. One of the greatest honors for a public media station is delivering on its promise to provide quality programming and news you can trust to the communities it serves. What you hear on air is the result of a dedicated team working together to bring you the best. It's a privilege to be a part of your day. Thank you for listening, for your feedback, and for your support.
Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. We are going to go back to the phones for a moment. Joe is in Juneau. Hello, Joe.
Hi. My name is Joe Emerson. I'm a commercial salmon troller, and I'm a former member of Wild Fish Conservancy. I'm also a member of Southeast Alaska Conservation Council, Salmon State, and Salmon Beyond Borders. Spent 22 years on Alaska Fish and Game Advisory Board, and I am definitely someone from the environmental community. I question Wild Fish Conservancy's sincerity in their concern about Chinook stocks and orca starvation. And I say this because Wild Fish Conservancy did nothing to inform their membership when there was a public comment period regarding the Chinook bycatch of the Gulf of Alaska and Bering Sea trawl fishery. They never said anything, even though I actually wrote a letter to Wild Fish Conservancy urging them to inform their members about this the bycatch issue in the trawl fishery. Then again, at the same time they're talking about orca starvation, they're concerned about it. Wild Fish Conservancy is also advocating the closing down of Chinook hatcheries in Washington State. Currently, 80% of all the Chinook in Washington State are produced by hatcheries. If we shut down those hatcheries, the orca would certainly starve. So I don't understand these two conflicting things regarding, their concern about Chinook and orca starvation. And also the elephant in the room that everybody needs to remember was the state of Washington and the National Marine Fisheries Service issued a permit to SeaWorld to extract 41 orca, and in the process, they killed between 11 and 14. Those 41 orca have now grown to a population of 59 in the different SeaWorld facilities. I'm assuming some were bred in captivity.
Joe? I guess we lost Joe. He made a number of points, and I want to get back to Paul here for a moment. Paul, describe the current fishery that's open now, and I believe it closes on April 15th. Why this isn't being targeted, but the fishery that opens on July 1st is. Why is the fishery currently open not being targeted? What's the distinction?
The fishery that is currently open is being targeted. So the troll fishery, Chinook fishery, is pretty much a year-round fishery. With a brief closure during the summer. So we have a winter fishery that goes from October 11th to April 15th this year. The closing day varies, but that fishery, the Wild Fish Conservancy would like to shut down. And then we have a spring fishery that targets mostly Alaska hatchery fish. Alaska hatchery fish, by the way, when Emma said 3%, I don't know where that number comes from. I look at the same stock composition data in Alaska. It's true. Alaska, like everybody managed under the treaty, catches various stocks, but our Alaska hatchery production alone is much higher than 3%. And that fishery occurs during May and June. And then our summer fishery opens July 1st, and they want to shut that down as well. They're not asking the court to shut down our spring fishery that begins typically May 1st and ends June 30th. So that's, and then the summer fishery has managed to catch basically 70% of the quota that's set under the Pacific Salmon Treaty that sustainably manages and allocates all the various fisheries. We're all in the same boat together, abundance-based managed. And so we will catch that. Typically, that fishery occurs over the first 2 weeks in July, and it's the most important part of a troller's income for everybody in the fleet. So, I mean, that piece alone is devastating to us. And then we typically have a second opening in late August where we catch another 30% of the fish, which help to feed people throughout the Pacific Northwest.
Describe why the Chinook fishery is so critical for commercial trawlers compared to other fisheries, other openings.
It's our premium product. It's prized by chefs around the world. See, when these fish are in the Gulf of Alaska, it's actually when they're in their prime. Their fat content is extremely high. They're feeding. And there's no better fish. There may be some like black cod or halibut that some connoisseurs might be competitive, but it is our top product. You go to Pike Place Market and, you know, you see them throwing the fish on Monday Night Football. We never do that. Don't ever throw a fish. They're each handled individually, hook and line. And that's why they're unique in terms of quality, because the fish is stunned the instant it leaves the water. It is dressed and chilled immediately. You just can't get a better protein product anywhere in the world, as far as I'm concerned, that's more sustainably harvested. So that, even though they are not our biggest catch in terms of numbers, they typically generate between $6 and $11 a pound for a troller, depending on the time of year when it's caught and other market factors. And they will retail for, you know, $40 a pound if you're buying one at Pike Place Market, or if you're eating it at a restaurant, it will be the featured entree. And without that availability, you just can't make it. No business can make it when you take away half of their revenue, and especially not a capital intensive business like trolling, where you need to buy fuel.
Right.
You need to employ shipwrights, welders. That's why this fishery is so important to us.
All right. Well, thank you for that explanation. We're going to go back to the phones for a moment. Deborah is in Sitka. Hello, Deborah.
Hey, hang on a minute. I'll turn down the radio. Okay, thank you for having me on.
And please get to your question quickly. We only have a few minutes left.
Well, I think the salmon treaty is getting some pretty disrespectful treatment here by some of the folks. We've been in this treaty with Canada, and it is a bilateral treaty. It's United States and Canada. So it's Washington and Alaska, Canada. And we've been doing tagging studies since 1985 that give us all the information on where these stocks originate from that are being caught here, and it's a voluntary program. You know, we turn in tagged fish, we make sure they're reported at the processors, Fish and Game turns them into reports. Every year there's annual reports at the treaty. Those reports are gone over with a fine-tooth comb. And we make the allocation decisions there based on keeping the fishery sustainable up and down the coast. And I want to speak to something I heard Emma say, that the Southeast Chinook salmon fishery is a lie because the fish don't originate in Southeast Alaska. And I thought, wow, it's in the hearing of those words. We call it the Southeast Alaska Chinook salmon fishery because it occurs here.
Right.
We never said they all originate here.
Okay. You know. Yeah. Thank you, Deborah. We are going to have to move on. We only have a couple minutes left here, and I want to give our guests a final word. Emma, I'm going to go to you, and I want you to try and be succinct here so we can get back to Paul, to the Pacific Salmon Treaty that Deborah was just referencing. It's reset every 10 years. Do you think this process, how the allocations are decided, the process itself needs to change? 2019 prompted a lot of reaction.
Yeah, absolutely. And I do want to say, to Deborah's point, we do think that the data collected that informs the treaty is actually quite sufficient. It's the decisions that are being made with that data that we are concerned about. I think ultimately we think this lawsuit demonstrates some of the sustainability issues. Again, the core principles being we should be sustainably managing stocks and ensuring equity for all communities. This is why I tried to touch on the non-Alaskan piece, not to say, harvesting them in Southeast Alaska or I guess I should say that that the impacts of these treaty negotiations has expands far beyond Alaska. And so many people in our region are asking questions and looking at the treaty and saying, why would our treaty negotiators go into a room and negotiate harvests that they knew was going to harm the recovery of southern resident killer whales and Chinook that originate from our waters? And so it's not just this fishery. There are other fisheries. If you talk to, you know, we have colleagues in BC who are very concerned about the 401 fishery in Alaska, southeast Alaska, that is targeting sockeye and harming Chinook and steelhead recovery in river, where, you know, they in some cases shut, you know, 60% of their fisheries down. And so I think it's in these cases when fish that, you know, when they reach their river may not be harvestable because the returns are so low, but are being harvested in communities far from home, really undermines recovery efforts in river. It undermines local economies up and down the coast. And so I, again, just would encourage people to think about the impacts of the treaty on not just Alaskan communities, but on communities coastwide.
Absolutely. Paul, your thoughts here, the Pacific Salmon Treaty reset every 10 years. Is that process working, or do you think there needs to be something changed about it?
The process, I think, is probably working within the constraints of habitat loss. All these things that people point to fishing are really habitat, particularly Puget Sound. So it's important to realize that Alaska trollers have taken a 30% cut in their ocean harvest from the treaty over the last 30 years, as have Canadian fishermen. And we have all done that, not because there aren't healthy, abundant stocks, as I previously pointed out, but because we are trying to minimize our impacts on stocks that are suffering because of habitat loss. When you look at the four species listed under the Endangered Species Act, for example, the Upper Willamette, the Lower Columbia, some of the ones that were being blamed, and you read the biop, it says harvest pressure has been reduced on those. Again, those aren't even far more migrators, but our fellow fishermen on the Washington coast, sport, tribal, commercial, have all reduced their harvests on those stocks, and they're not coming back. Why? Because of habitat loss, dams, riparian, loss of riparian forests, estuaries especially. The degradation of estuaries in Puget Sound is phenomenal. I mean, go for a drive, you know, from Olympia to Bellingham. And those are some of the most important habitat for Chinook salmon. So the salmon treaty is working within the context that we are having and continuing to have major habitat problems that support Chinook salmon. And they're doing the best they can, but they are definitely, unlike what you've heard today, they are definitely taking the orcas into consideration, and we are all losing opportunities to harvest the readily available fish in order to protect the weak stocks. Everybody's doing it. Every fishery, tribal, Canadian, U.S., Alaska, we're all harvesting less of abundant stocks in order to protect the weaker ones. That's the basic principle of the treaty. Make it sustainable.
All right. Thank you, Paul. Emma, in just about 15 seconds here, beyond the southern killer whale concern, you mentioned other stocks of concern in Alaska. Is Wild Fish Conservancy considering any other legal actions that target Alaska fisheries?
No. There's nothing that we're planning at this time.
And is there any indication of when the judge may issue a decision in this case?
And maybe Paul could weigh on this. I have not seen any indication of when the judge could weigh in. I think, I would be hopeful because of some of the considerations Paul mentioned about allowing fishers to plan and have some certainty. We've encouraged the court to make that decision sooner rather than later.
And Paul, have you heard of any indication of when a decision may come out?
No, the judge really doesn't have a strict deadline to make a ruling. So it could come out tomorrow. It could come out several months from now. It might depend on his caseload. It might depend on whether he's questioning the magistrate's report and recommendations.
Okay, so, we'll have to leave it there.
We're all on hold.
All right. Thank you so much to my guest today, Paul Olson, a board member of the Alaska Trollers Association, Emma Halverson, the executive director of the Wild Fish Conservancy, and Max Graham, a journalist based in Haines. Our engineer today was Chris Hyde. Our producer is Madeline Rose. And on the phones, Michael Finelli helped us out. I'm Lori Townsend. We'll be back next week. Thanks for listening.
Talk of Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. This is Alaska Public Media.